Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. Today's program is a little off the beaten track. Several weeks ago, I reviewed the raw footage for a DVD, Surviving the Mob. This documentary explores the time that Andrew DiDonato was part of the Gambino crime family. So interesting is his story that I arranged an interview with him. Since that time, I've talked to Andrew on quite a number of occasions. What eventually led to his downfall was not only the fact that law enforcement were searching for him. He'd been on the run for something like 6 months, but the Gambino family themselves had placed a price on his head. With no viable options, he became a government witness. Although he cooperated fully, he still had to do some time. He pled guilty to a bank robbery. Oh, but this was no regular, you know, threaten the teller and walk away with $2,000 deal. This was an almost $500,000 hit. While I have no intentions of setting up a bank heist, hell, the tellers in my local bank all know me. You know, hello, Mr. Simon, they say when I walk in the door. But I did think it would be an interesting subject to discuss on the radio. To help me digest the information, I'm joined today by my good friend, Denny Griffin. Denny is a crime writer. He has a number of books in print, and he specializes in true crime with an emphasis on organized crime, the mafia, in other words. Denny, welcome to the program. Hello, Denny. Oh, we might just have temporarily lost Denny. Either that or he's gone for a cup of coffee. I understand that Denny drinks an inordinate amount of coffee. Also joining us is Andrew DiDonato, ex-Gambino crime family member. He was part of the witness protection program. However, a couple of years ago, he decided to withdraw from it and has gone public. His mission now is to try and persuade people that the life in organized crime is not what you see coming out of Hollywood. It's a brutal life, and it comes at a high price. Andrew, it is great to talk to you again.
It's great to talk to you too, Simon. Thanks for having me today.
Oh, my pleasure. My final guest this afternoon is also an ex-bank robber and ex-organized crime member. For reasons of personal security, he prefers to remain anonymous. I know him merely as Joe. Joe was a career bank robber. I doubt that many people can put on their resume that they have 18 years experience in the field. Joe, it is wonderful to have you on the program.
My pleasure to be on the program.
And I do believe that we have Denny Griffin back with us. Denny, it's great to have you on the program.
Well, thank you, Simon. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yes. Yep, life is fine.
Great to be with you and your guests.
Oh, they're a strange bunch. In fact,
you ain't seen nothing yet.
my wife has reached the stage where she goes, "Oh no, the phone's ringing. Is it an ex gangster or a spook?" Joe, I know that you're a little tight on time. I want to start with you. I had the pleasure of talking to you a couple of days ago, and you said something interesting. And it was backed up by an article that I read about a Gambino family member yesterday, in fact. The statute of limitations goes out the window when the feds use RICO. Now, this article actually went on to say you can steal a stick of gum at age 9, but with RICO, they can still bust you. You cannot win a RICO trial. Now, as I understand it, the statute of limitations had elapsed for some of your crimes, but it was RICO that they got you with.
That's correct. All my crimes were statute, what's called statute of limitations, barred. The statute of limitations, it's written there in our Constitution due to the fact that, you know, 5 years down the road, if you're a person that could be possibly innocent, and you know you don't have a witness from 5 years prior, you can't place yourself where you were 5 years prior. But they came out with this law, this RICO law, racketeering law, and what they could basically do is go back until 1973, and like from 1973, from the day the RICO Act was enacted, all the way up till date, and charge you with a RICO conspiracy. So if other members of that conspiracy, members that you didn't even commit crimes with, if they continue with that conspiracy and you never withdrew from that conspiracy, you could be charged for the actual crimes that you committed, even though the statute of limitations barred. You could be charged for a RICO conspiracy, a violation of 18 U.S.C. 1961, and it carries a 20-year penalty in prison, in a federal prison.
Wow. Andrew, were you charged under RICO or just for the?
No, I wasn't charged under RICO. I had charged with the bank robbery in general, right there, that bank robbery case, and I had a weapons possession charge. And being that it didn't go back that far, that they didn't have to charge me with a RICO. They were able to charge me straight out for the crime federally, and I admitted to other criminal activity such as, you know, smorgasbord organized crime activity across the board, you know, promoting gambling, extortion, you know, bank robbery, a number of shootings I was involved in. So they didn't have to, as far as that was concerned. I've learned through the court system what constitutes a RICO is two predicate acts within a 10-year time span. You know, even if you weren't convicted, if you have an arrest for that, and they could show that you use that criminal activity to, say, gain possible advancement within the crime family, they could use that 10 years later, just as long as it's within that 10-year window. But like my friend Joe said, they can go back as far as, you know, 1973, and if there was anybody who started committing crimes then, and then you caught up with them a few years later, I believe this article that you read, the gentleman was saying that he was 9 years old when the conspiracy had started.
Right.
But what happened was, a few years down the road, he had caught up with those guys who were committing crimes when he was 9. And he became part of that conspiracy at some point in time. So, yeah, they were able to do that.
Denny, what do you think of the RICO statute, if you will? I mean, is it fair?
Well, probably not. but it's certainly the feds have used it with great effectiveness, and look at the number of mobsters they brought down using that. So, and you know, there a lot of the defendants have had some top-notch attorneys working for them, and apparently this thing is the RICO has held up all these years. So, you know, I always have a problem with anybody when you ask somebody to prove their innocence from 20 and 30 years ago. I think it's a tough nut to crack. But, you know, that's the way it is. Like I say, the feds are using it very effectively.
Okay. Let's talk bank robbery 101. You know, this is the University of Bank Robbery. As I see it, there is absolutely no mileage or future in walking up to a teller and demanding his or her money. You may score $2,000 Actually, I think the average is something like $2,200. That's not the jackpot. I mean, you can't live for very long on $2,000. Vaults, night deposit boxes, deliveries are the way to go. Andrew, you managed an almost half mil hit. Joe, as I recall, your biggest was almost $900,000. You didn't do it without planning. Joe, how do you plan a big hit?
You plan by watching, by surveilling, by just laying on a place and you know, thinking using your talents, or basically what you're taught by other persons, and you're handed down by the persons you're taught to use it, and you know, to do it correctly, and you know, the most important thing is to get away with the crime. So you look for every angle that you could do it and get away with it. The other thing is make sure it's important that there's plenty of money there. In case you do get caught, it'll be worth your while. You're not getting caught there for $2,200, like you said. $2,200 when I was rocking and rolling was basically nothing to me. It was just, you know, $2,200 was, I don't know, maybe a night of drinking, a night out drinking and eating dinner, and that would be $2,200. So with $2,200 when I was committing crimes, I couldn't do anything with $2,200. And I wasn't doing drugs. I was just, you know, whatever, living a regular life.
How long does it take to put together a heist?
Well, certain heists can be put together in a week. Some might take months. Some might take years. Years of planning and years of thinking about it. And, you know, and you might leave it on a back burner because it's a little hard. And, you know, and one day you just come up, or you see that you see a loophole in there. And, wait, you know what? We could get it this way. Let's try it this way. Let's see if we can get it that way. And it sounds like a good idea. And you go through your partners and it sounds great, and then you move on it. Or the biggest one that I did took basically like days of planning. You know, we got a tip on it. We got information from someone that there was money downstairs being counted, and we actually didn't move on it 2 days later because the armor truck company beat us to the bank. But we moved on it the following week. So basically, in 7 days' time, we were able to plan and execute, like you said, almost $900,000 robbery.
Andrew, yours was half a mil, and you have told me the story before. And essentially, you guys did something similar. You had the situation.
We had some inside information, Simon. Yeah, we had some inside information. We had, as a matter of fact, one of our co-conspirators on the case was happened to be in the bank when the delivery came. He was in there, happened to be cashing a check. And as a matter of fact, we weren't even thinking about doing that bank. We were at that particular time, we were sitting on an armored car drop in Manhattan, and he had gave us a phone call the following day after being in the bank. He was there cashing a check, and he seen the money truck come. He seen the guy come in with the bags, and he noticed that there's no partition between the teller and the customer was number one. Number two, instead of taking the money into the vault, they would take the money and leave it at the foot of the vault. And being it was a Thursday when he caught the move, they were very busy with the volume of customers. And he noticed while he was standing there that they didn't go and, you know, touch those bags at all, that they left them there until, you know, the customer base had died down and they had a chance to actually go and, you know, take that money into their back rooms. So it laid on the floor there for about a good half hour. So he seen the window of opportunity. Now this particular individual was, you know, an old school bank robber. He's been doing it for a very long time. So he came to us with the idea the very next day. We ran up the flagpole. We sat on the a diner down the road from the bank where he knew that armored car usually stops for breakfast. We watched them stop for breakfast this particular day. And we followed them to the bank, and we seen what kind of bags they brought in, gave us a general idea of what kind of money to expect, and then we knew how, the following week was a Labor Day weekend. And we knew that usually on a Labor Day weekend, from our experience from, you know, talking to guys such as me, talking to guys like Joe in particular, who was a dear friend of mine for a very long time, and, you know, guys around his crew who ingratiated me with their friendship throughout my life. I learned these things from them, that on holiday weekends you'll have a bigger influx of business due to ATM volume, being the banks say will be closed on that particular Monday. The holiday weekend starts on a Friday. They load those ATMs on a Thursday to make up for that volume of business. So say if the ATM usually holds, say, X amount of dollars, it'll be doubled throughout that weekend, throughout their 80, ATM 000. Machines.
80,000, Andrew.
Excuse me?
80,000 each machine.
80,000 each machine, yeah. So what it came down to was that on this particular branch, we noticed they had a number of ATMs in the foyer area, and then whatever they would use for their customers. So we had it based out that there would be anywhere between 200,000 to 300,000, we thought, on the busy weekend. So that's what we planned it for. And we did. We scored. On the following week, we waited that Thursday. We waited outside the bank, and we waited for the money truck to come. The money truck pulled up like clockwork. As soon as the money truck came, when they dropped the bags behind the counter, I walked in with another co-conspirator. We walked in like 3 or 4 seconds behind one another. I didn't say a word to anybody. I had a baseball hat and sunglasses. I walked straight to the teller's booth. I jumped over. I grabbed the bags like they were my own. I threw 2 bags over to my co-conspirator. I took the other 2. I jumped over. The only thing was there was a good Samaritan in the bank who tried to challenge me as I was jumping over the counter. And my partner inside the place had took him from behind and threw him across the floor without a word being said, and we continued on our way. And we walked out of the bank with nearly $500,000. And
wow.
It took about maybe 40 seconds in time, maybe a little less.
Mm. Denny, you know what?
Yeah.
We're in the wrong business. Yeah, there's no money in writing books. We should be out there jacking up banks.
Actually, you guys are in the right business. So we were in the wrong business, actually.
We were in the wrong business for sure, because it sounds good. Tell him, Joe, it sounds good.
It sounds great, but you didn't have to sit in the jail cell.
Simon, can I ask the 2 guests a question?
Certainly.
Go right ahead, sir.
Okay, what I'm curious about is, since I've never been in that line of work, I'll rely on your expertise. Maybe you could each answer this. It seems to me if you're going to knock off a bank, you obviously need enough people involved to accomplish what you need to do. On the other hand, I would suspect you don't want to have too many people, because the more you have, if you don't really need them, the more you people each that share in the score, which diminishes each one's end, and also the more people that might talk at some point. Is there an ideal number of people for the average bank robber? Like 4 or 6, or would there be
There's no ideal number. It's basically like you says, in today's day and age is how many people do you trust to keep a secret? Today's day and age is very little. Back when me and Andrew were on the street, it was a lot different. You could trust a lot of people to keep a secret. It wasn't rampant where guys would go and just tell secrets. Later on, it became a fashion thing, and now it's very hard for someone to keep a secret, but you could go with as little as one person and go on a bank robbery by yourself if you wanted to, actually. Or you could go with whatever is necessary to accomplish the job. And like I said before, the main thing is to get away.
And one follow-up question on that. If there's a case, Andrew was telling me about one of the capers he was involved in at one point where he couldn't make it the night the robbery came down. I think it was one of the bank burglary. But he had been involved in the planning and stuff, and at the last minute had to cancel out. But he ended up getting his end of the score.
Yeah.
So that's commonly done. I mean, if somebody's involved all the way through and then for some reason has to cancel out at the last minute, they're generally included in the and when they divvy up the proceeds.
Sometimes
because it's part of your friendship. and it's part of your crew. So in other words, if me and hypothetically you, Dennis, were involved in something, and you know we were in the street and we planned this together, and you know every day we put our heart and soul into this, and then at the last moment, for reasons, you know, act of God, or you got locked up, something happened, I'm going to see to it that at least I put, you know, send some money to your family, whatever it may be, from that score. I'm not going to leave you in a lurch. I'm going to be there to help you in any capacity that I can. You know, you're my friend. You didn't back out because you wanted to back out. You backed away either to protect the score or to protect the integrity of what you were doing because you didn't want to get people in trouble. With my scenario, I was wanted by the parole department, and I thought, you know, I had some law enforcement, what we call in the street heat. I had some heat on me, and I thought that if I went and did the robbery that day, I might have blew the score for everybody, and even worse, maybe got them arrested on the site. So I stood back to protect the guys that I was doing the job with, you know. And but for the most part, about your other question about as far as, you know, how many different guys on a score, basically what you want to do, though, is you want to have enough on the score where you got a guy who listens to the scan, he's listening to the police radio, he's there to pick up any calls that might be going off, that, you know, an alarm was pulled, that the police are coming to the scene. You want a crash guy in a perfect setting. You would like a crash guy. His job is to do nothing but to keep you safe. You guys come out of the bank, you get into your getaway car, and you drive away, and a good Samaritan wants to follow. The crash guy's job is to crash that guy's car to make it look like an accident, to take him out of the picture.
Okay.
And, you know, you got guys who had certain responsibilities in a crime, but like my friend Joe said, you know, you could do it by yourself, but to do it the right way, to get away with it, because that's the bottom line, to get away with it, you want to do it in a way that you're going to protect yourself and the others around you at all costs.
Okay, now, Joe, your technique of bank robbery isn't actually bank robbery. I believe it's called bank burglary. You much preferred to tackle banks at night.
I did both, Simon. I also let the banks during the daytime. That robbery for $800,000, we did enter the bank in the daytime and take the money from the tellers. Not the tellers, actually, the people in the basement counting the money up in the vault area, in the counting room. That's where we took the money from, in their presence.
How on earth do you get down into the vault?
Oh, into that area, we were able to break open a door that wasn't alarmed the night before, and basically use that door for entry into the basement, into the vault area.
Wow. But many of your escapades were bank burglaries.
That's correct.
Right. And as I understand it, the favored spot was the night deposit box.
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit about how that kind of scene goes down.
Well, I don't want to give too many details because maybe someone listening in on the radio might have some extra time and might need some money and might attempt to do it. But basically, what we did we were able to dismantle the night depository box, and we used these special tools and stuff like that. We used some homemade tools, and we used a homemade fishing gaff with an extended stick on it. You actually withdraw the bags out of the night depository box once we dismantled the actual box itself. So we were able to take all the deposits that were dropped there during the weekend by the stores that used the night depository box.
So the ideal day to do this would be late Sunday night, early Monday morning?
Well, the ideal time is on a what we call a four-day weekend, on a holiday weekend. That's the ideal time. The best time to do it is usually Martin Luther King birthday weekend, because all the biggest sales are out that weekend, so everybody's out shopping and spending money that weekend. Those are the biggest sales of the year. So Martin Luther King's birthday that weekend is the biggest spending weekend, the biggest retail weekend of the year for stores.
Joe, obviously robbing a bank is a dangerous game. I mean, if you get caught, you're going to jail.
Right.
How do you estimate the potential take?
Well, like a night depository box, you might just park a block away, or if you can't park a block away, we might have parked the car with a hidden camera in the car and recorded the activity at the night depository box. Usually activity at a night depository box is usually like a 2-hour busy time where stores start closing and the people from the stores start going there. So we would see how many count the bags, how many would go into the night deposit box. And on a robbery, it's like I said, I really don't want to give that information because someone with a little bit too much time and not enough money might attempt to do it themselves.
Right. Okay. Andrew, I want to go
yes,
back
sir.
To finding the crew. How do you find the crew? I mean, I know that both you and Joe were involved in organized crime. However, the particular bank bust that you got busted for was not Gambino sponsored. It was a number of people, and some of them came from other families. Is that common for the families to work together?
Yeah, well, you see, when you were in the street, Simon, you could be with any different crime family, and you could work together, unless, you know, your bosses dictate otherwise. You know, you could earn with whoever you can in the street. I mean, give a hypothetical. Me and you could have grew up in the same neighborhood, and instead of you going to the Gambinos, you went to the Lucchese family, I went to the Gambinos, but we still have that childhood friendship. So if, you know, I know I could still trust you. I know that if I have some stolen property, something like that, I can go to you. We could exchange stuff. You know, we have that friendship and that bond. So, of course, it's a little unorthodox sometimes. You know, guys like to stay within the family or whatever when they have something special to do. But for the most part, I think we spoke about it a few days ago when we spoke over the phone. It's more or less, it's reputation. You get a bunch of guys together and they know they can trust you. They know that, you know, you did a little jail time, or they know what your position is within your own crime family. With me, with these guys who I did the robbery with, they had a guy on their crew was dying of cancer, and they needed somebody to fill his spot. And they asked me to come aboard. And when they asked me to come aboard, it opened up a whole new world for me. At the time, I was on the run, and I actually needed that like oxygen. So to me, it was like a shot in the arm. And I was really, like I say, back then, I was really grateful that they would take me in to do this. And I just was on board from that moment on. But for the most part, it's all trust. It's guys you know who are going to be on the score, who are going to take your back. You know that they're going to be there to protect you at all costs. You know they're good at their job. Like me, when I was in the street with Joe, and, you know, I had, you know, been in Joe's company quite a few times, and for that 16-month time period that I was on the run, 16, 17 months, whatever it was, they ingratiated me. They took me on board with them out of our long friendships. Me and Joe were from the same crime family, just two different factions. You know, we lived about 10, 12 miles away from each other, but I know him since the early 80s, and, you know, that helped a lot. And when I needed it, it was there for me. So that's how the crew was picked. And what happens is you might have a guy go to jail, a guy who's on the run, a guy who's not around, and then it's good to be able to go to other people to fill that void and know you have a strong pool to choose from, which we did. We had that back then, like Joe said previously. Years ago, we could trust each other. It isn't like today where the bosses dictate everything, and they're not setting the example that they should, as years ago they did.
Okay, Joe, you were involved in bank burglaries and bank robberies. Now, in either case, I know that you have, stopped robbing banks, but even back in your heyday, that they had surveillance cameras. How did you deal with those?
For instance, one burglary I was arrested for, we were able to sneak up behind the camera, and even though the camera was high up, we were already well prepared with like a roller, a paint roller stick, the extended one, and we were able to push it towards the sky. So say for instance, the camera at one point at 12 o'clock was pointing at the night depository box, and at 12:01, the next picture frame was pointing at the sky, and had never seen anyone. If we couldn't sneak up on it, we would send a guy that was normal weight, normal height, with the stick and with a ski mask on and you know, baggy clothes, and make him push it up. And other times during burglaries when we were inside, we would take the videotapes, and during robberies we would attempt to take the videotapes also. The videotapes are usually kept in the vault area.
Well, this is all good tips. I'm going to be writing a new book, you know, Bank Robberies for Dummies.
That's what we were, Simon. We were a bunch of dummies. If we would have known any better years ago, we would have did a job like you're doing today. Believe me when I tell you.
Exactly.
Denny,
we would have got a different education, let's say. You got to understand, it was part of our education was because of where we grew up and the area we were raised in. We had older people teach us the trade. It wasn't like, you know, it was handed down, the trade. It wasn't like we just thought one day, let's go and rob banks and let's go and do this. We both grew up, even though it was 10 miles apart, Andrew's neighborhood and my neighborhood were basically entrenched with organized crime, and they are still today. And that's what these people handed it down, you know, and they gave us the outs for stolen merchandise, whatever it was, stolen cars, furs. We would have the connections within the families to be able to off products. So that's what made it easy for us. Is we were raised and we grew up, and that was the education that we both took. We took an education on organized crime, unlike a very small percentage took an education in whatever other fields. In lawful fields, me and Andrew, we decided to go to the illegal field that we thought was the field that we prosperous, but obviously
the easy way out. We took the easy way out.
Exactly. We figured, okay, that's what I want to be. I want to be a gangster when I grow up, you know. And it didn't turn out too good for us.
Denny, you're our deep thinker.
Yes.
What do you make of this conversation?
I find it very, very informative and very interesting. I've always enjoyed talking with people who have actually done these things and try to, you know, understand the thought process and why they did what they did. And it brings me to another question that I'm interested in an answer to, and I'm sure there other people will be interested also. Is when you pick or get associated with a crew to go on a score, be it a bank robbery or a major score, does it ever come up in the planning stages or when you're recruiting or deciding who you're going to do the job with about the actual use of violence? I mean, is it each man for himself makes their own decision, or does somebody during the planning stage say, look, we aren't going to kill anybody unless such and such happens. Other than that, we might wave the gun to intimidate, but we aren't actually going to get a murder rap unless we're in such and such a position. Does that kind of thing ever come up during the planning stages, or does each guy decide on his own at what point he's going to use his gun?
Okay, I'll answer you. I'll give you my point on that. The guys that I grew up with and the older guys that we were taught by, we were taught never to harm anyone for money. Never to harm, physically harm anyone for money. You take their money and that's it. It's very simple. It was very simple for us to go and get an armored truck loaded with money, lay up on the roof and shoot them and pull up with a stolen car and take all the money. We weren't that. We weren't that type. We weren't ready to commit violence. We weren't going to commit violence in any shape, way, or form for monetary purposes to gain money. We wouldn't do that, and we were told, we were taught never to kill, and most organized crime guys are taught that, never to murder for money. Organized crime guys don't murder for money. They'll murder to protect their money. Most of the time, they'll murder their own kind, another soldier, another member of that crew. You understand? But there is instances where you do have members of organized crime that are addicted to drugs and they don't think straight and they do stupid things like that. They'll use an actual weapon. Like on my robberies, we never used an actual weapon. On one robbery, we used a pellet gun, the one we took $900,000 from, without a CO2 cartridge in it and without any pellets in it. On the other robberies, there was never a handgun used.
Andrew, did you ever use guns in your...
No, as a matter of fact, Simon, when I did the... When I was on board with the bank burglaries, like my friend Joe just said there, you know, we went there, there was, you know, it wasn't even a thought in your thought that you might hurt somebody doing a bank burglary. It was never even an option. When we went to go do the bank robbery, I'll tell you what I did do. I was the upfront guy. I was the guy who was going in. So being that I was going in, all I did was I wore a bulletproof vest. That's all I did. But I didn't brandish a gun or nothing. I walked in. I didn't say a word to a customer. I didn't say a word to a bank teller. I jumped over. My only job was to get those bags. And when that gentleman came and challenged me in the bank, all he was is he was taken and thrown across the bank floor. But that was just to get him out of the way. There was no, you know, there was no such thing as going in there and if they don't do what we say, you know, we're going to use violence. No, we're there for the money and the money only. And like anything else, it could be, you know, somebody, you know, we have families as well. And, you know, if, God forbid your family walks into the bank or one of these things happen, you want to make sure that the person who's going in is just looking for the money, he's not looking to harm nobody, and that's that. And like Joe said, this is the way we were taught. We were taught if you're going to use that, any sort of violence, it's going to be either to protect yourself, or, like he said, you take somebody else, it's usually another soldier within the family. You're going to protect your own money, or somebody's trying to rob you, or whatever. But in the bank, no, I did not. The gentleman that was with me in the bank, he had a gun. He did have a gun, but he never took it out. He never used it. He never even offered it up as, what I could say, as intimidation. It was just on his person. But it was like that was for protective purposes, period. And I was never involved in it. I know we did have a conversation with them because we had sat on an armored truck previously, you know, a few times. We used to follow trucks around and see whatever. And I remember one of the guys saying, now I was brand new to it. I was more of a student at the time. And he said, listen, he says, we don't commit violence to get what we want. He says, of course, we like to go there and, you know, you want to intimidate. He says, or you want to catch them short. You want to catch them sleeping so you don't have to actually do these things, he says. And I remember him saying that the only time, he said, the only time that I would ever, he said, I can't remember what the figure was. He said, the only time that I would justify violence, he says, if I had $5 million or more in my car, he says, and I'm driving home with it, he goes, and somebody tried to stop me from going to my house, it might be the only time, he said, that I might initiate violence, he said, but on the scene, never. You know, on the scene, never.
Let me add something to that. Another thing that me and Andrew were both trained is, if we get caught on a robbery, we get 10 years. We get 5 years, or at the most 10 years. We got caught on a burglary, we get 4 or 5 years. We were trained to be able to accept that prison time as young kids. Like, it was part of that. We knew when we go out there, we can go to prison. And it wasn't no big deal for us to go to jail. Okay, it was part of us doing business. It was just a more of an education, a further of our education into organized crime, a furtherance in a way of us to prove ourselves as being stand-up guys with an organized crime. So the prison time doesn't scare you. It's not the prison time that scares me or scared Andrew. That doesn't have any effect on us. When we go out and commit a crime, we know that we can go to prison, and we didn't have a problem at that point going to prison.
Okay, Joe, let me ask you a question. I know that eventually you got busted. Was that the first time you'd been busted?
No, I was arrested numerous times since the age of 13 to the age of 32. Numerous times. I can't even tell you how many times. I was arrested by the federal government on 3 different cases, though, I could tell you that. And another time I was charged civilly by the federal government. So basically four times I was charged by the federal government.
Ouch. And Andrew, I know that you had numerous run-ins. I mean,
yeah, I had a lengthy criminal record. My earliest arrest goes back to 1982, I think, was my first actual arrest. Then there was a few more afterwards. I say one, two, three, and I went away to prison for 5 years in 1989. So I was like my friend Joe said, we were no stranger to the jail system. As a matter of fact, I remember one day making a comment said that we had more friends inside prison than we did on the street at one time. You know, every one of our friends was being a target by law enforcement in some way or another. And I believe I said to somebody in another interview that maybe they should do a census to see how many single mothers are walking around in my old neighborhood, because everybody's in prison due to the activity. Because organized crime, like Joe said, is entrenched in my neighborhood. It's like in the fabric of everybody's lives. And it seems to be the norm where I come from. And it's destroyed so many people's lives and so many different generations. Generations before us, generations now, and it'll be generations after. And none of us ever learned. We didn't learn. We thought that we were going to be the exception. Me and Joe were out there. We were committing crimes, double-fisted. You know, bank robberies was just the tip of the iceberg. I was out there committing extortion. I was out there robbing drug dealers. I was out there shooting. You know, I was doing all your basic organized crime activity. And it was just part of your normal, everyday life. And it wasn't normal. And not until you in the position we are now, where you look back upon and you know that your life was a runaway train. And, you know, you did damage to so many friggin' people. And that's why today, if we could try to help somebody, this is what me and Joe are trying to do. We're trying to stop, you know, that cycle, especially in our neighborhood. Our neighborhood is just ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. You know, we don't have any heroes in our neighborhood. Yeah.
There's no heroes.
There's definitely no heroes, you know what I mean? And but for the most part, I mean, getting back to your other question, I got something interesting to say, and I think Joe will, you know, understand where I'm coming from. Is this aspect of it is I remember that we had a score downtown in Manhattan on Stone Street. I can even tell you the street it was on. There was a robbery we were going to do on a Brinks truck, and there was a gentleman who was involved in that, you know, in the planning of that robbery, and he was a well-respected organized crime figure. He was a made man in organized crime circles. He was with the Bonanno crime family. And the guys that I was going to do the score with had got a taste of how this guy operates, and they didn't want him on board. They didn't want him on board in the score. Even though the score was his, they wanted him to just let the crew do the score and him stay on the sidelines. And the reason why is that on a previous robbery in Manhattan, he had showed his true colors and he had left the scene. He walked out of this basement setting. He walked out with two bags of money in his hands, and he seen a scooter cop turn in the corner, and what he did was he got afraid, and he put the bags down on the sidewalk, jumped into a taxi cab, and left his crew there. And what happened was he left $1.1 million on the sidewalk, and it was on the front page of the news the following day. And now these guys know, you know, he's a made member of the Bonanno crime family. So they had a big argument over that. They had a sit-down, so to speak, over that particular incident. And then they had another sit-down over this incident about having him on board on this particular crime. And we told him, listen, we know what your score. Why don't you stay home? We'll give you an M. Just stay home. And this is what we wanted to do. And even though he was in organized crime circles, he wasn't allowed on board for the actual crime of something that was his to begin with, because of that reputation. So it's a double-edged sword. So when you're picking a crew to do a robbery, even the guy who holds a position within a crime family could get slighted if he didn't prove his mettle when the time came of it.
Or he could get killed. See, that would be the reason that we would have committed bodily harm for somebody doing something like that, leaving someone behind.
Yeah, and it was a big to-do over that because there was a lot of money on the table, Joe. There was a lot of money, and everybody was thinking about how much money. And it was, I think we had it figured out, and we had a connection inside the Brinks department. And we had a connection, and they had the number of how much money it would be, the number of the truck, the whole bit, and it was too much money to worry about hitting this guy being on the scenes and blowing the score. And like Joe just said, there was a lot of talk about this guy one way or another. We decided to put the crime off for the later day, hoping that this guy would go about his business. One day we would do it unbeknown to him and move on. But we all wind up going to jail anyway, so we didn't do it.
Denny.
Yes.
You hang out with these folks way more than I do. And I know that we've discussed this before. That there is honor in organized crime. I mean, it's not like the street gangs of today where, drive-by shootings are the norm. I mean, that does seem to be a genuine effort to not hurt people. Have you found that?
Yes, well, I think what you have, and I'm going to use the word to describe Joe and Andrew, is when they did their jobs, their careers at that point, they did them in a professional manner. In other words, they planned their scores. They were looking for, unlike these people you see today or hear about today, they knock over a convenience store for $11 and kill two employees or something. I mean, that I find no justification for that kind of stuff. But what they did, they treated it as a business, in my opinion, and they planned as well as humanly possible. They did not go in intentionally with guns blazing to wreak havoc as far as leaving a lot of dead bodies in their wake. They went in for the money. It was a business. And, in fact, two of the books that I've done, or one I've done with Frank Collada, who's a Chicago outfit guy, and now, as you know, I'm working on a book with Andrew, and our agreements, and you might think I'm crazy for this, but my agreements with two former mobsters was done on a handshake. I did not hire a lawyer to try to pin these guys down because my feeling is, after dealing with former mobsters now for several years, is, and this doesn't apply to each and every one, I'm sure, but the ones I've dealt with, that they have certain codes of ethics even today, even though they may not be any longer involved in the street. And I trust them more than I would a lot of politicians, I can tell you that much.
Actually, I like that.
I'd be a good politician.
I'd vote for you any day. I'd be honest with you. I'd be on the front line. I'd be voting for you in a minute.
I'll be hanging all the legal crooks, the guys that think they can rob the public.
Jesus, right?
Yeah, I always said they want to have a death penalty. Have a death penalty for anybody that holds public office, that takes a bribe, accepts a bribe, or facilitates a bribe to get the death penalty. Then we'll see how many death and issue it out automatically. Don't leave it up to the U.S. attorney, general attorney to make the decision. Give them the death penalty, even if they steal a dollar or they take a penny bribe. Give them the death penalty, and then maybe you'll see them stop and committing crimes and stuff
Joe,
like that.
Joe, if you campaign on that, you got my vote.
I know. I'd have everybody's vote, because that's the problem with
Simon,
this country and the rest
Simon,
of the world.
Okay. Hey, Simon, getting back to the honor system. The honor system amongst us years ago was a lot different than it is today. I mean, today, I'll give you for instance. Today, guys in the driver's seat or in the boss's position within crime families are not the same bosses that were in the early 80s when I was first coming up, or even in the 70s. They come from a different cloth. The guys of today are more or less run their soldiers into the ground, where the respect is expected to go up the ladder, but not down the ladder. So guys like me and Joe, we would get used today by these bosses for our skills and for our mindset of trying to do what's best for the family. But In reality, they don't have our best interest in mind. And that's why you have a lot of guys today, like me and Joe, who are becoming government witnesses, because they're starting to realize that they've been sold a bill of goods, that it's not, you know, what they were brought up to believe in, that system is not in place anymore the way it used to be. I grew up with a set of values that if you got 100 years, you take 100 years on the chin, you keep your mouth shut, and you go to jail. And I would have been all right with that. I would have been all right with that. But when these guys just want to kill you over money and no other reason, or they want to run you into the ground, it's a narcissistic life, like I said once before, is I know I'm being unfair to you. I know I'm putting your back to the wall. I know your family's going to suffer. I know your wife and kids ain't going to have nothing. But at the end of the day, you're going to do what I tell you to do, or you're going to be forced, like I said this once before, to turn into the thing that you were raised to hate the most. And my money's on that you won't do it. You're not going to become a rat. And this is the position that they put you in. Now, I'll take my responsibility for becoming a government witness. The writing was on the wall for me. I knew that my life was in danger. I knew that I was in a position where I couldn't win. Now, Joe will tell you, you know, I wasn't the toughest guy on the street, but I had a reputation as somebody who pulls the trigger. You best believe it. They knew it. But I couldn't win because you're facing the guy who's a boss of a family, and somebody's going to be looking to take that bounty on your head to try to make a name for themselves. So it would be, you'd be in a position where you'd have to hurt numerous people. And what am I going to be, a 5 or 10 minute conversation in a bar that, you know, hey, that I was, you know, I went out in a blaze of glory? No. But for once in my life, I started to see the life of what it really was and how, you know, started to see the potential in myself. Now, hey, I could do something good with myself. Let's do it. And I'm sure Joe will agree. Now, you know, life is so much more simpler. You know, there's no more waiting for that knock on the door to come for a crime that I committed 6 years ago. You know, those days are over. You know, every time the doorbell rings, your heart's in your mouth. Is this the day law enforcement picks me up? Is this the day that this happens to me? Is this the day that happens to me? And I think, you know, the bosses of today need to take the responsibility of how many guys are turning and why they're turning. There's no people skills in the upper echelon positions, so to speak. All they do is run you into the ground and take and take and take from you.
Use you until you can't bleed no more. Once you can't bleed no more, they throw you in the garbage.
You know, you're only as good as your last favor, and everybody needs to understand that in the mob. You can make millions of dollars for these people, year after year after year. Cost them money just once and see what happens. Cost them money and see what happens.
Yeah, you know, I've spoken to you, Andrew. I've spoken to Frank Collada, and obviously I've spoken to Joe. There's a very common thread here, and that is, you know, the foot soldier is expected to do exactly what he's told. However, when the shit hits the fan, all bets are off.
You tell everybody hold the bag. Yeah, the bag's yours, now hold it. What I did and Andrew did, we gave him the bag back and told him, you know what, now you hold it.
Yeah, truthfully, think about it honestly. Here you are, I'm supposed to throw myself in harm's way once again to protect the very people that I know want to kill me. Now, I don't know, and see, the life is so narcissistic that they believe that even though they know that you know they want to kill you, they still expect you to protect them. And that's the selfish part of the life. Oh, my God, I can't believe he turned. Oh, I can't believe he did this. Me and Joe didn't wake up one morning and decide to turn our backs on the only friends that we ever had. No, we didn't.
It was a road.
No, we did not.
It was
but
a road, Dad.
We woke up. Yes, but we woke up, and that's what it was. We woke up to the realities of what was around us, of what was happening, you know? And like he said, here's these guys, they're making millions and millions of dollars. Millions. And now all of a sudden now, they're going to start to what? I've been with this guy my whole life. You're going to start to what? Extort me? Because you think I did a robbery and you want to do this, that, the other thing. And I'm on the run at the time. Here I am on the run. You're a millionaire. You're looking to extort me on the run. That's just the mentality, you know?
They are.
Because, and nobody's expendable. Nobody, what's the word I'm looking for? And nobody's the exception, Simon. Nobody. Nobody. You know, Yeah.
Now they're holding the bag. Like I said, now the payback is there. Now you do what you want to do now. So basically, yeah, you were going to hurt me. You were trying to get over on me. But now, you know what? It's your turn. I'm getting over on you. Here you go. You know what I'm saying? It's payback. Here's your change. You understand what I'm saying? So basically, that's what they got. They got what they deserved. And, you know, now they could do what they want, too. Some of them cooperated. Some of them won't. And it doesn't matter anymore. Like Andrew said before, there's nothing you can charge me with. I told them everything. He told them everything. So have a nice day. Have a nice life. You know, if you want to tell, go ahead, be my guest. And that's it. There's one saying right now. At this point, it's three people could keep a secret when two of them are dead. So there is no more secrets. There is no more honor. That's all gone.
That's all gone. It's all it's all bullshit. And what they do is they try to sell that to young kids coming up today that, hey, this is honorable life. You keep your mouth shut. These are your friends. These are your family, blah, blah, blah. Let me tell you something. You go to jail, you do a 10 or 15-year bid. Your wife will be on welfare. Your kids won't have no clothes. Nobody will come and see them. You won't get a $10 bill. You won't get nothing. Maybe if you're lucky, you get a few choice guys who look out for you every now and then. But for the most part,
$50 in 2 years after my second indictment. They sent me $50. There you go. With love, they sent it to me. $50.
Hey, Simon?
Yes.
I just wanted to, you know, we started out talking a little bit about RICO, and you asked me my opinion, whether I thought it was fair. But, you know, Joe had personal experience with RICO. I'd like to get his opinion. Obviously, it's held up to legal challenges, so legally, I guess it's okay. But, Joe, what's your opinion on the fairness of RICO, about how far they can go back and so forth?
According to the Constitution of the United States, it's not fair. The law shouldn't be there, in fact. Marine Midland Bank got convicted of RICO. I mean, it's basically anyone can get convicted of RICO. There's no bars. The law was specifically written to be able to arrest Italian criminals, which were organized crime criminals. Robert Kennedy put this Robert Blakely on it. The reason Robert Kennedy did it is out of his own greed, his greed to hold the offices. We all know the stories who put them in offices. The father, he was a criminal himself. The father was a bootlegger. He brought bootleg liquor. They still get a percentage on the liquor that comes into the U.S. But the father went to organized crime members that were trying to outright make their lives better, and they controlled the unions, the labor unions, when this country was great. The dad went to them and got their votes. I've been a member of the union. I've seen what goes on during union meetings when there's an election coming up. The union president will get up there and he'll say, you know, I think if we vote for so-and-so, he'll do right by us. We're going to get more work. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. So I know how they get the votes. Basically, John F. Kennedy's dad went to the union guys, who were mobsters that controlled all the unions at the time, and got their votes. Robert Kennedy says, wait a minute. These goddamn greaseballs, excuse my language, are going to control this country one day, which it was going to, and it still could happen. I mean, you know, his daughter has three half Italian babies, so he must be turning his grave. But make a long story short, is he did it. He wrote it for his purpose, for his own purpose and his own gain, you know. And that's what happened there with that law. So the law could it's totally unconstitutional. The U.S. Constitution calls for something that's supposed to be within plain sight, plain view. It's not supposed to cross any gray lines. The RICO Act states that you could cross over into gray lines, and it states it right in the act. So it's not a fair law, let's say. And, you know, it's used against gangbangers today, but they first started using it against members of organized crime, biker gangs and that stuff. Does it work? They're making state offenses criminal offenses. I was charged with a federal offense to begin with, but you ran out of statute of limitations, and you come back with me on a state statute for robbing a bank teller. That's a state statute. You charge me for RICO, so you go around the bank robbery. You're not going to charge me with a bank robbery statute that you already have on the books, because you can't, because it's 10 years down the road. So you're going to charge me that way. You're going to put me in prison for 20 years with it. So in certain instances, is it needed, like for the major corporations? Sure. You know, is it needed for Marine Midland Bank? Sure. But today it's being used too wide and too far flung. You know, it really shouldn't be on there. And specifically, who ordered the RICO statute to be written? It was written by basically criminals. You know, the Kennedys, nobody's offense if they do like them. They were criminals. Their dad was a criminal. Their dad was a bootlegger. He was no better than me. He might have killed people. I don't know if he killed people during the bootleg. I'm sure that he had to kill people to protect his bootleg business. So basically, his sons were just basically his seeds. He showed them what to do and how to do it. He got them into office by buying other criminals with favors, and that's what he did. So it's something that's written by criminals. It shouldn't even be on the books. You know what I'm saying? It should be rewritten and written the proper way if you need this law on the books.
Hey, Simon, the first guy to get convicted of a RICO, the first guy to get convicted of RICO in organized crime circles was a guy named Frank Thierry. His name was Funzie Thierry. He was the boss of the Genovese crime family at one time in the 70s. He got convicted of that, the RICO statute, in 1980. He was the first one that the government seen that it worked upon. He got convicted. He wound up dying of throat cancer, I think in 1981 or whatever, so I don't think he did much jail time, but for the most part, he was the first Italian-American gangster to get convicted of the RICO.
Joe, we have avoided talking about your family allegiances. That's probably a good idea. The Gambino family has been in the news for the last few weeks. What do you make of this latest bust? I mean, there's 14 of them or 15 of them that have been indicted. And, yeah, there's RICO stuff, but there's this really, really sad part about them apparently running an underage prostitution ring on Craigslist. I mean,
okay.
That doesn't sound like good business to me.
All right, let me explain something to you. I was incarcerated one day when a Russian fella came in and he was charged with child pornography on the internet. I busted his head with a triple C battery. I don't like child pornographers. I don't like any pedophiles. So if I was still incarcerated, that's what I would do to them. I would bust every one of their heads. They wouldn't be able to live in a prison unit with me. They're pedophiles to me. They're garbage. They're the lowest form of any kind of criminal that there could be. And that's what's coming up today in business today is pedophiles. They're pedophiles. Anybody that gets involved in anything like that is a pedophile. Whether I'm a turned person and I change my ways, if I was in prison today, I would split their heads open. And that's from the bottom of my heart.
You know what, Simon? The funny thing is that in the street years ago, and my friend Joe here will tell you, within our bulk, within our crews, if we would have known that guys like this were doing this kind of activity, one or two things is we'd stop them fucking immediately where they stood, is number one. They'd be out of business in no time. Number two, they couldn't even hold a fucking conversation with us, let alone be part of the day-to-day activities of the Gambino crime family. Now, I don't know what's happening out there. I see a few high-profile guys that I knew throughout the years on that indictment who I held in very high regard when I was on the street. These were guys that I respected. And basically the bottom line is I was glad when I heard through the grapevine and through news articles that they didn't have anything to do specifically with that charge on the indictment. But I know one thing, and I'm sure Joe would agree, there's very few things that kind of high profile that the bosses don't know about. So somewhere within the crime family, there's somebody who knew this was going on. And my opinion is years ago, this guy would have had a very big headache back 15 years ago, whatever it may be. In today's Gambino crime family, I don't know if that's still going to be. But years ago, this guy would have had a serious headache. And I mean, he would have been marked for death. They would have chased him. They would have ostracized him. He would have had nowhere to turn, nowhere to go. I mean, don't get me wrong.
He would have to cooperate with the government right now. I would
believe that. I would say that. Now, don't get me wrong. There's been guys in the past who were involved in sex clubs, this, that, guys that I knew years ago, they had pieces of places in Manhattan or whatever the case may be. And you know what? Nobody ever really spoke about that the way they should. But I can say one thing. I may not agree I may not have agreed with the way the bosses turned out to be when I decided to cooperate, but I never knew them to be involved in such dirt. That I did not. I was not privy to that, and I would assume that they feel, even though they might not agree with my decision to cooperate, I assume that they would agree with what I'm saying right this fucking minute, because there's one guy on the indictment who was my cellie. Me and him were cellmates for months. And I say to myself that I know that this guy has got to be rip-roaring mad that his name was on the same indictment as these kids, who are, as pedophiles. Because this guy is a high-profile guy. He don't need the money. That I can tell you right now. He don't need the money. So
yeah, maybe
he must be
change.
Really... Yeah. And, you know, he must be spinning in his jail cell right now. The room must be spinning that he's involved with these guys on that, that his name would be in the same headline as these kids. I don't know what the repercussions are going to be today, but years ago, these guys would be dead.
And the thing to tell you guys straight out is that basically at the bottom in the convict code, at the very bottom, is a pedophile, and these people were pedophiles because they're charged with selling a 15-year-old girl. That makes them pedophiles, and I mean, that's the bottom. Any convict in prison will hurt them just on general principles, because you can't be no worse than a pedophile. After a pedophile is a rapist, after a rapist is a woman killer. So you know, that's the bottom. The way on the bottom is a pedophile. And I mean, these people are just they're scum. They're garbage. They ain't worth 2 cents. So they.
And that gives you an idea of what the guys today, the gene pool they have to pull from today to get new talented guys. So that just goes to show you the kind of shape organized crime will be in a few years.
Denny, I'd like your opinions. You know, you're the mob expert. The mob has changed
drastically. From the law enforcement side, it's changed for the better. I've never written about the old Dons, the old so-called mustache Pete, but I've watched a lot of, I've read about them quite a bit, and I've watched a lot of documentaries and so forth, and I think what Andrew and Joe have both mentioned about the bosses of today and being users, and I think Joe said taking until you have no more to give. Somehow I don't associate that attitude with the old-timers going back in the 20s and 30s and the Lucianos and these guys. And I could be wrong in that, but all the reading stuff I've done, I never got that feeling. I had the old mafia, maybe it's a myth today, but the old days about they take care of each other, like Andrew was saying.
Well, they were better businessmen.
That's
what it is. They were better businessmen.
I can tell you one thing. My great-grandfather was a member of Cosa Nostra. Where they came from in Sicily, they were called men of honor. Now, a man of honor, the standards are the same as any honorable person. Just the only difference is that they would commit crimes that weren't allowed by the government. The crimes they would commit mostly is extortion and murder. And that's what they did into the 40s, and then they got into the dope business. But back when they were called men of honor, they weren't called friends of ours or whatever, or made guys. They were all men of honor. That's what they were. They were men of honor. And there is no honor in pimping a woman off. There is no honor in especially pimping a 15-year-old girl off. You know what it is that, like Andrew said about the gene pool, they don't have any heart. If you want to be a criminal, you know, put a gun in your hands and go rob someone. If you want to be a criminal, go get a crowbar in your hands and go burglarize something. Go stick a screwdriver in your hand and go steal a car. Do something like that, but you ain't got no heart. You got no courage. When I say no heart, means no courage. They don't have any courage to do those things. So it's very simple for him to get a naive 15-year-old girl and threaten her to have sex with men. It's very simple to get a drug-addicted girl to go have sex and give you money. That's simple. That's a coward. That's a yellow dog. That's what we call them. And that's exactly what they are. And it just falls to anybody that had any knowledge of it or anybody that okayed that, it goes all along the line.
But would it be reasonable to assume that, you know, what Andrew said was true? The big bosses knew it was going on?
Definitely. They knew they were involved in a prostitution business. I'm not going to say they knew they were involved with a 15-year-old, but they definitely knew that they were involved with the prostitution business, because how it works is these guys, they score brownie points by telling them what businesses they're in and giving them money, kicking money up from whatever businesses they're in, illegal businesses. So they have to tell. If you don't tell, and especially if they were cowards, they're going to get killed. You understand? Like me or Drew may go on a score and not tell no one about it, and everybody that's there, we're not going to say nothing about them. We're going to pocket all the money. You understand? But these guys here, they want to score brownie points. They want to get made. So how you do that is by giving money up and kicking money up, and that's exactly what they were doing. They were kicking money up from it, so they know where it came from. They got a prostitution business. They got a call girl business. Is that allowed? It's not allowed. Not a 15-year-old or not a 20-year-old. You're not supposed to be in a prostitution business. There's guys that are in it. They're supposed to be in there on a sneak, just like you're not allowed to sell drugs. But the prostitution business is worse than being involved in drugs because you're looked down upon. I can tell you what, in Italy, you'll get more time for being a pimp than you would for killing someone. That's how much it's looked down in Italy.
Ouch. Oh. Denny.
Yes.
Times have changed. I mean, this is an ugly scene. This latest Gambino arrest deal is actually very ugly.
Yes, it is, and it's surprising. And we were talking a while ago, I think Joe was saying, about the Kennedys and rolling over in their grave about the some of the offspring there. But I got to think that if
his daughter got injected with three paid American kids by a dark skinned gorilla looking guy, Andrew Cuomo, which is a great guy.
if there was some way to communicate with the old timers, you know, I'd have to wonder what they would think. What would a guy like Luciano think of these latest arrests, you know, or Carlo Gambino? I mean, I don't know, maybe Joe or Andrew would venture an opinion. What would some of the old dons
I'll give you a quick
think?
Opinion on it. Luciano was a pimp himself, right? So
Luciano, yeah,
Luciano
was
me,
a pimp. He got arrested with it. Yeah.
Yeah. To me, Luciano was a pimp. He was a punk. Carlo Gambino,
okay,
he wouldn't have been involved in that. That's my opinion on it.
Okay.
Now, Drew, go ahead.
I believe the same thing, because Luciano got caught up in a case. They were able to track the prostitution ring right back to him. So it was going on years ago. It was going on. I mean, he got like a 30 or 40 year sentence for that crime. I mean, they threw the book at him. They threw the book at him for that crime. And of course, we all know that he created what we believe to be the modern day organized crime, the way it's ran, you know, the way the structure is, you know, the boss, the underboss, you know, and how there's a committee between the families to arbitrate arguments or territories or stuff like that. But for the most part, I think that a crime like this, more than anything else, brings unnecessary heat. And I know that this is something I learned long ago, and this is something the bosses don't like. This is why they used to shun their noses at drug dealing out in the open, because the drug dealer brings heat. And when heat comes, you can't earn. And when you can't earn and the bosses can't put the money in their pockets, somebody's going to die. And that's the way it goes. If somebody gets in the way of a dollar bill, they're going to get hurt. And that's what you see today. This particular crime took guys off the street that didn't want to be off the street. This particular crime put guys in harm's way, and it affected their pocketbooks. And like I said, I don't know what the repercussions are today, because it's not the same as it used to be. But I'd say years ago, it was definitely going to be a toe tag on somebody. And they're going to hold somebody responsible for it at some point. There's going to be one particular person who they target with this, and all the blame's going to go on this one person. And then you're going to see this person do the flip-flop. He's going to become a government witness because he's going to know that they're dropping this in his lap, and he's going to be on an oxygen tank, and it'll come. They already have government witnesses on the case. There was a guy who wore a wire. I mean, I read up on the case a little bit. So they got their witnesses already in place. So then the truth is going to come out soon, who was in the know. The truth will come out soon, who approved it, who was in the know. But it's an embarrassment. It's like mud in your face. You know, it's like egg on your face having a situation like this, you know, to the crime family.
Well,
but
I know we've talked several times, and, you know, rule number one, you want to keep a low profile. You're in the business to make money, you know, whether it be boosting banks or, extortion, the numbers game, but you want to keep a low profile. When your profile comes up, the family doesn't like it. I mean, I'm sure that was what happened to you, Andrew. I mean,
well,
you know,
yeah, what happens is this, Simon. Look, yeah, it's a secret society. That's what it's supposed to be, a secret society. Yet today, if, say, they're going to induct you into the family today, Simon, you're going to get straightened out. Before you get to your induction ceremony, the FBI knows you're getting made today.
Before you do.
Before you get there.
they send a list over to the FBI before it goes over to the other families.
Yeah, before they paste your name to the other families to let them know that this is a guy we're proposing for induction in our family, the FBI knows, all right, what's his name's getting made on Wednesday. All right, we'll see what happens afterwards. That's how ridiculous it is because, now, years ago, I had an uncle of mine who was a captain in the Genovese family. Okay, he was a high position guy in the late 70s. And I remember not until the 80s, I mean, after he was murdered in 78. And I remember into the early 80s, you didn't hear as much capo, captain, this guy. You never knew what kind of position a guy held in a family. You just knew he was in a position somewhere. This guy was a respected guy. You didn't know he was a captain. He was an underboss. Now it's like, they know who the underboss is. They know who the captains are. They know who's made. They know who's up for promotion. They know. I mean, it's ridiculous now.
They tell the bottom of the association. They tell the bottom who's the boss, who got promoted to captain. They tell everyone now. It's not a kept secret anymore.
Yeah, it used to be a kept secret. It used to be a secret society, and a secret society went out in the mid '80s. And I don't point my finger at John Gotti in any way. You know, they got their own troubles over there, you know, the Gottis, and, you know, they had their hands full with a bunch of stuff. But I do know a lot of guys were upset with John Gotti Sr., who I was personally friends with, old-timers, who believed that they got exposed for the positions they held in the family because of John's comings and goings and high-profile appearance. Now, I don't have anything to say on that matter. I just say that here's what guys who were in the life for, say, 30-some-odd years at the time, and the government didn't even know they existed. Now, John became boss at the time, and then these guys were exposed. You know, I'm not in a position to say whether it happened or not. I wasn't privy to what was going on as far as that was concerned, but I did get a lot of guys that I was friendly with who were old-timers who voiced that opinion to me, that they blamed him for their troubles.
Okay. All right. I need to say goodbye to everyone. It was a pleasure
conversating
with everyone.
All right. Goodbye, my friend.
Take care of yourselves, and it was great conversating with everyone. All right? Take care. Have a nice day.
You got it. Have a good day, my friend.
All right.
Thank
you. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
We can talk again. Let's go back to the bank robbing business.
Go right ahead.
In my opinion, the third component, you know, you've cased the joint, you know how to do it, you've made the hit, you know, whether it be jumping the counter and throwing bags to your buddy. The all important thing though is the escape. I mean, how do you do
very
that?
Important, Simon. It's very important, and you know what? And I can tell you, you know, you always have to figure in the variables because nothing ever goes according to plan. You could plan, plan, replan, write it up, whatever the case may be. The stage sets itself on its own on the day of the event, and that's what happens. You know, you don't account for somebody walking into the bank when you're coming out. You don't account for somebody being in the way of the car when you're going to drive away. You don't account for somebody to, you know, a good Samaritan, somebody who's aware of the surroundings and see what's going on, who sees suspicious guys in a parking lot or something like that. So it never goes according to plan. The best you can do is get the best plan in place possible with the minimal risk of getting caught. But you still need that percentage of good fortune as well. You do need it. And on this particular robbery that we're speaking about that I was involved with in 96, our escape was a little bit more convenient than others. What had happened was the gentleman who was involved in the conspiracy with us, he lived within a very, very short radius to the bank. And it was a straight run to his home. So after we robbed the bank, we drove directly to his residence. And when we did so, we were off the street within less than a minute. Within a minute's time, we were off the street. So any and all calls that came over the radio, whatever cars they're looking for, whatever, it didn't matter. We were already tucked away in somebody's residence, unbeknownst to law enforcement or anybody else, and we felt fortunate within that scenario. But that scenario was not always there for you. Other times, what we did is we would go to the location. We would take a stopwatch with us, and we would go at all different times of the day to see how long it would take us to get to our drop-off points at the busiest times of the day, the lightest traffic times of the day, and we would graph it. And then, of course, you got to figure in as to when is the best time to rob the bank for the money being available to you. So we've done that time and time again, go over it, go over it, go over it. And I'd say, you know, robbing the bank, I shouldn't say is the easy part, but it's the getaway, like you said, which is the most important part, because without the getaway, anything you rob, you know, it goes right out the wayside if you don't have the proper getaway. And there's a lot that goes along with it. Crash guy, somebody who's going to put themselves in harm's way to protect you. You know, if they see somebody following you, they'll crash them. If they see a law enforcement car coming, they'll crash the law enforcement car. And they'll just make like, you know, they lost their brakes or they lost this, that, and they'll play stupid. But that's their responsibility. And it's like if you're a running back on a football team, you're running to the end zone, you need blockers. And you need those blockers to help you. You know, you have to have a place where you have another car available to you so you can get out of the car that they're looking for and the switch and, you know, get the guys away from the money, put the money in one area, put the guys in the car in another area. There's a lot to be considered with it. There really is. And I think that a lot of people get caught today. I don't know what the statistics are, but I say to get caught on the scene is very rare. Very few people get caught on the scene. You know, I know there was a high-profile bank robbery in California at one time. I seen these guys, they just stood in the bank. They had an arsenal with them. They had that big shootout with the police. And, I mean, ridiculous stuff. Why in God's green earth would you do stuff like this? Harm all of these people for money? I know. I think those gentlemen were just mentally ill. But for the most part, you're taking away what you're there for.
Was that the two guys that had full body armor on and...
I mean, you're going there for money. It seemed to me that these guys were going there more or less to hurt people. So why would you go to a bank? If that's the case, just go to a, you know, something like that. And, you know, it just seemed to me like two... To me, they weren't bank robbers. To me, they were just two guys who were mentally ill. It didn't seem to be that... Because they in no way, shape, or form, it seemed like wanted to get away. It seemed like they just wanted to go out in a blaze of glory and... They were looking to harm people. And unfortunately that does happen with certain robberies, you know. And, you know, not everybody has that discipline, Simon. Not everybody. And it's like anything else. I would rather, if I was a convenience store owner, I would much rather get stuck up to a guy who has experience instead of some young kid coming in with a gun and waving it in my hand. Because there's a good chance when that young kid comes in, you're not going to live.
Right.
And, you know, a seasoned veteran or somebody who's just there and knows what he wants, you got a better shot. You really do. But, you know, I was involved in these things and just in organized crime in itself. Like you said earlier, it's a brutal, brutal life. It really is. It's a brutal existence. There's no good retirement plans. Not many people get to reap the rewards of the money they stole over the years. They usually rot in jail cells, or they find themselves a fugitive from justice, and their families suffer. Basically, that's the bottom line. I mean, you know, we could talk about different guys, different scenarios, different errors, and basically, at the end of the day, the stories are all the same. He either died in prison, or he got killed with a gun in his hand in the street, or he's on the run at some point in his life. So, you know, that's what you walk into. But I don't think that people realize, you know, you put a robbery together, and it could be, you know, like I think Joe commented on it before. He said, you know, his biggest score that he made, you know, it only took a week to plan. It only took a week to follow it through. Sometimes these things fall on your lap. Other times you could plan something for a very long time, and you could turn out to get nothing. My first bank burglary was a disaster. The first bank burglary I was involved in was in Westchester, New York. We went there with these two gentlemen who, you know, had some success in committing bank burglaries, and what they would do is they were using construction equipment to rip the boxes or expose the money. And on this particular day, we did that. These guys went into the bank with a machine. They, you know, they ripped the box out of the wall, and they didn't do what it took to break the thing open to get the money. So all it turned out to be was a really, really expensive vandalism. And that was my first taste of a bank burglary. And here I was standing in the parking lot like, Jesus Christ, look at this. And it sounded like a plane crash. I mean, it was so loud. It wasn't like we were, like, being burglars. It was like we were going there. I mean, you could have went there with a rocket launcher and caused less noise. But these guys were successful in doing it. And they had took two or three of my colleagues on board with us to do it, and we thought it would be something to do, and we went, and it turned out to be nothing but a vandalism. And I knew that wouldn't be something that I would be want to do again, as far as their way, the way they thought that it should be done. I thought that it caused, too much of a commotion, that, you know, you're bringing too much exposure to yourself. But, you know, not every one of these things is so easy, and it's, I've planned so many, and, you know, I used to wake up in the morning. My job was, Simon, here's what my job was. I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning like I was going to a regular job. I get in the car, I pick up one of my co-conspirators, I get into the car, we drive. We go downtown Brooklyn to Kent Avenue. Kent Avenue is a depository where the Brinks keep their trucks. What we would do is we wait outside in the car down the block, and we'd follow a truck. Today we follow this truck. We follow it on its route all day long. We see where they pick up, where they eat, where they go, where they come. We mark everything down. We move on. We get the number of the truck somehow. We move on. The next day we follow another truck, follow them around. It's a full-time job. And you do it so you could either find the weak spots in these, in these trucks. You know, you want to see creatures of habit. People are creatures of habit. You might want to go out every Tuesday to eat hot dog at a specific hot dog stand. Every Tuesday, we know you stop at such and such, such and such and such and such bank, and then you go eat at this hot dog stand. So we know where you're vulnerable now. We know that every Tuesday you're going to go here. People don't realize it, but after a while, that they're delivering this money, it's not money to them anymore. It becomes just a basic, abstract subject.
Yeah, it's product.
Yeah, it's product. To them, it could be Campbell's soup in the truck. You know, after a while, they stop counting. I'm sure when they first get the job, they must say, wow, oh, my God, I moved $3 or $4 million today. And that might last a few months. But if they're on the job maybe a year, 2 years, after a while, they don't even look at the bags anymore. To them, it's just bags. And then they fall into what they say. They get complacent. They get comfortable. Because I'm sure they're not as attentive as they were the first few months of their job. And like anything else, they just fall into that complacent, and that's how they get caught short, and that's how guys are able to get the drop on them or catch them in a bad, uncompromising positions. You know, and I give those guys a lot of credit. And I'll tell you why. Because they don't get paid very much money. And they have a really, really dangerous job.
Oh,
they put their lives on the line. I think their starting pay for that job is like $11 an hour. You know?
Wow.
And when I think about it, I mean, Simon, we thought of so many different variables. I used to have a brain.
Too much then found and wait to see what happens.
Hello.
Are you still there?
Yeah.
No, it's for the credit card.
I'm not sure what this is. We're right at the end of the show.
Hello?
My switchboard seems to have absolutely gone crazy. And Andrew, can you give us a quick wrap up? I need to close this show.
Well, the wrap up is this. It doesn't pay. No matter what people may think that you could do, at the end of the day, keep your legitimate job, and you'll be a lot happier in the long run.
And Denny, are you still with us?
I'm here. Well, well said, Andrew. Well said. It's a fascinating look into the world of organized crime, and just covered one tiny aspect of it today with the bank robberies. I mean, there's so much more that out there that needs to people like Andrew and Joe to be exposed for what it is.
And you can rest assured that I will be working hard to do exactly that. I want to really thank everyone for joining us today, and I know we will be talking again soon.
Thanks,
so,
Simon.
Thank you very much, Simon. Speak to you soon.
Okay.
Bye, Andrew.
Bye.
Bye.